People who automatically think detention center when they hear the name Guantanamo may not be aware that the U.S. naval base had been operating just outside U.S. and Cuban law for 100 years before it housed any post-9/11 terror suspects. In her new book called Guantanamo, Janet K. Lipman examines the base's history from the perspective of its employees, the men and women initially from Cuba, later from Jamaica and the Philippines, who've cleaned, cooked, built and repaired the base for the American military for decades. Her book is published by the University of California Press, and I'm pleased that it brings Janet K. Lipman, an assistant professor of history at Tulane University, to the show today. Hello.
Great. Thank you very much.
What got you think about writing the base's history from the perspective of its employees?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I believe that when most of us think about Guantanamo, you're right, we think of these men in orange jumpsuits. But my research began actually before September 11th. I was in Cuba doing research on Jamaica-Cuba relations, and I met a man who grew up in Guantanamo. And he talked to me about how his parents worked on the base, but that he had then joined the revolutionaries and been part of the Cuban Revolution. And for me, it was amazing to think of what did it mean to live next to the base and yet fight with the Cuban revolutionaries.
Now, when you said he grew up in Guantanamo, you're talking about the city of Guantanamo. Many people, even Cubans, you say, frequently confuse Guantanamo Naval Base with the city of Guantanamo. It's Cuba's fourth largest city?
That's right. It has about 100,000 people. And just to give listeners a sense of the geography, first of all, I've never been to the base. The base is about 45 square miles, and it occupies most of the bay. The city of Guantanamo is about 10 to 12 miles north of the base. It has about 100,000 people. It has a network of buggies, cinemas, entertainment facilities, a baseball team, and it is a fairly large provincial capital.
So why have they shared this name for the past 100 years?
Well, Guantanamo was the original name of the city, and it's the name of the bay. And when the United States gained the U.S. military base after the U.S. War of 1898, or what's often known as the Spanish-American War, that's when the military adopted the name of the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay.
Has the city thrived because of its proximity to the base?
I would say that it goes back and forth. If you look at the 1940s and 1950s, the base was a very important part of the Guantanamo's local economy. You had sailors and Marines going off the base. They would be buying things in the community. There were prostitutes. There were bars. There were all these types of, you know, commerce that you would associate. And so compared to the sugar economy, this was considered to be an important economic engine. At the same time, there's a lot of resentment. This isn't necessarily the best type of development for a community to have in order to be prosperous. There's a great deal of poverty as well. And that after the revolution, when that commerce really ends, Guantanamo's economy really has been stifled, particularly because it does not have access to the bay, so it can't use the water for tourism or fishing or other types of economic development.
Since the United States began using Guantanamo as a detention facility several years ago, there's been discussion in the media about how the base isn't fully governed by U.S. law since it's located outside the United States. Didn't you discover that this idea was actually nothing new for the Guantanamo facility?
That's exactly right. And in many ways, the base has always had this nebulous situation with the law. I'd like to go back a little bit to sort of give the framework for how the legal process was set up and then explain a little bit more about why it always has this ambiguous history. So first of all, I am a historian, so we have to go back more than 100 years. And in 1898, the U.S. enters what we learn in high school as the Spanish-American War. But if you're Cuban, you learn this as the Cuban War for Independence. And the Cubans have been fighting for their independence since 1868. So for them, this is the very last act of what had been a 30-year war. And you had Cuban nationalists who wanted to be independent from Spain. And rather than being independent, the United States comes into Cuba, and the Spanish surrender to the United States, and Cuba essentially becomes a U.S. colony at this point. The Cubans are not happy about this. They want to be independent. They don't want to be a U.S. colony. And the United States says, well, all right, you can be independent, but under two conditions. The first is the United States can enter militarily, again, whenever it wants, and the U.S. does intervene militarily in the early 20th century. And secondly, that we want a base in Guantanamo Bay. We want a U.S. military base. Cubans don't like this. They're angry. They're resentful. But they say, all right, fine. We want to be independent. We'll accept those conditions. And the lease agreement says that Cuba will have ultimate sovereignty, but it will be under U.S. jurisdiction. And this is a contradiction, right? How can it be under Cuban sovereignty? It's a lease. The U.S. doesn't buy the territory. And yet the agreement says it will be under jurisdiction of the United States.
It's also an open-ended lease. Does that mean the United States can stay into perpetuity?
Essentially, it does. The lease does not have a date. So many people ask me, you know, even just a few moments ago, how many years is it? When does the U.S. lease up? It's not a 99-year lease. It's not a 100-year lease. The lease says that both parties need to agree to end it, which means that one country, for example, Cuba, can't say it's over. So the U.S. can stay indefinitely as long as it continues paying its payments. It also says, and this is the part about the payment, that the U.S. will give the Cuban nation, at this point, approximately $4,000 a year. And for anyone who pays rent or has a mortgage, we know $4,000 a year is, you know, essentially peanuts for 45 square miles. But the U.S. writes the check to be in compliance with the lease. And that's where the United States bases its legal status in the naval base.
My guest is Janna K. Lipman. Her book, Guantanamo, A Working Class History Between Empire and Revolution, is published by the University of California Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So I was asking about the legal status for people who work there. These employees have been struggling for years, haven't they, with not being fully protected under either American or Cuban laws as a result of this deal.
That's exactly right. And one of the things which I found remarkable as a historian, I wasn't going looking for these stories, but that people in the 1940s were asking these same questions. What law is on the base, U.S. law or Cuban law? They weren't asking it as a constitutional question in the way that we think about it today with the detainees. But, for example, if you had a Cuban worker, he was asking in 1940, do I get paid U.S. minimum wage or Cuban minimum wage? If I get hurt on the base, what protects me, U.S. protection or Cuban protection?
How is that resolved?
It often stayed ambivalent and ambiguous. You had letters from Cuban workers as well as from foreign workers saying that the United States follows whatever law is most convenient to it. Sometimes it follows Cuban laws, sometimes it follows U.S. law. This also became key when you had a private company on the base, which again I believe would be familiar with most of our listeners and readers today, which is you had a private company on the base in the 1940s during World War II called the Frederick Snair Corporation. And this company was told by the U.S., you don't need to follow Cuban law because you're not operating within Cuba, but you don't really need to follow U.S. law because you're operating outside the United States. And the workers were resentful, and they said, essentially, you should make a decision. And in many ways, the U.S. played it both ways.
And we're seeing the same thing happening in Iraq these
days.
Exactly. Although you write about the base from its creation up until the present, you've focused on the years between World War II and the mid-1960s. Why? Is that because that's when there was a larger presence than there's been at other times?
That's when most of the workers there were Cuban, you know, the largest number of Cubans working on the base. Before World War II, the base really was a relatively small outpost. It still did have an important economic function in the community of Guantanamo. We're talking 200, 300 U.S. sailors and Marines stationed there. After World War II, you have thousands of men being trained there before they go off to fight. And that means there was also an intensive building on the base of construction as well as workers. In 1964, this is when the majority of Cubans are fired after the revolution. It's actually 5 years after the revolution. And after that, most of the workers become these privatized third country nationals from Jamaica and the Philippines.
Although some Cubans continue,
exactly.
And we'll get into that. But we're talking about a sizable number of people from the city of Guantanamo coming over every day to work on the base. So this, and whether they were unhappy about not being covered fully by American laws or Cuban laws, they were still paid better than other people in Guantanamo, weren't they?
That's exactly right. And one has to recognize that the other major option was the sugarcane industry. So if your option is to be cutting cane or to be working for the U.S. military, the U.S. military offered higher salaries, offered more consistent employment, often offered the opportunity to get advancement on the base. So it was seen as a privileged group who got these jobs.
But were they also ambivalent about it? Because there was obviously a lot of anti-U.S. feeling in the country because of the base.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things which my work tries to demonstrate. Often when we think of U.S.-Cuba relations, it's black or white. You know, either they're anti-Americanists or they're Cuban nationalists, or they, you know, come to the United States and become at least the government in Cuba. And what my work shows is a much longer history of ambivalence, that there was both a desire for the economic security, but ongoing resentment. And one of the cases where perhaps there's the most resentment is in the case of Kid Chicle. Kid Chicle was a worker in 1940 who tries to get a job on the base. He's one of these young men who says that this is going to be better for him to get a secure job. And he's not picked. He doesn't get a job. He's not lucky enough to be one of the lucky few. And he's standing on the docks, and there's a U.S. Marine who's in a boat bringing people over to the base. And this young man jumps into the boat, and presumably he believes that he can convince someone to give him a job. And at that moment, the U.S. Marine pushes him out of the boat. Presumably he hits him with a blackjack or a stick. And the young man falls out of the boat and into the bay. And he then dies. And this becomes a huge case in the city of Guantanamo, because even though they all want these jobs, they still recognize in many ways their insecurity and the fact that the U.S. military does have more power. And this becomes a case in the city. People go on protests. They wear black armbands, possibilities of a strike. And there's a great deal of concern about this event.
In fact, in the 1950s, didn't they even form a union?
Mm-hmm. That's right. And this was something which, again, surprised me. When I was looking about the naval base, I didn't expect to find an American Federation of Labor-affiliated union. And in 1950, the union is formed. And this union is formed as part of the AFL's anti-communist unionism throughout Latin America. The goal of the union was, in fact, to prevent radicalism. What I found quite interesting about the union, it was a very top-down union. But the union did successfully get better wages. It was able to give greater protection for workers. But even more critically, the base workers who were the leaders of the union went far beyond what the AFL anticipated. And so in the story that for me was most alarming as I was reading it in the archives was the story of Lorenzo Solomon. This was, again, a young man who worked on the base, and he allegedly stole $1,500 worth of cigarettes off the base. And this is one of these cases, there's lots of petty theft. Generally, what happened was that he would then have been sent to Santiago, which is the local court system, for trial. In this case, Lorenzo Solomon was detained on the base. And when he comes off the base, goes to the press, and he says that he's been tortured. And he says that he's been detained for 2 weeks. He's not been given official charges. He's been forced to stand for hours, that he's been beaten, and that he has been told that if he doesn't sign the confession, he'll stay there. He signs the confession.
This sounds like a precedent for today's Guantanamo accusations.
I mean, for me, it was just shocking. And this is from 1954. So I'm sitting there in the archives going, you know, I can't believe this.
Do you think it's likely that he did go through all of that?
I believe it's likely that he was beaten. I believe he was definitely detained for 2 weeks. All the debates about what constitutes torture, what's not torture. He was clearly beaten and clearly detained for 2 weeks. And when he comes out, he makes these allegations to the press. And this is the point of the union. It's the union leaders who come up to defend him. And it's the union leaders who say, he might have stolen the cigarettes. We don't know. But you don't have the right to detain a Cuban worker.
My guest is Jonna K. Lippman, Assistant Professor of History at Tulane University and author of Guantanamo, A Working Class History Between Empire and Revolution. It's published by the University of California Press. We will continue our conversation after this. You may have suspected that there was a connection between Guantanamera, the song, and Guantanamo. Well, there actually is. It is about a country girl from Guantanamo, and it was popularized in 1928 by Joseito Fernandez Diaz, a Havana singer. We just heard a version of it performed by Company Segundo. With me is Jonna K. Lippman, who's written Guantanamo, A Working Class History Between Empire and Revolution, published by the University of California Press. So what happened when Castro's revolution began? Were there some Cuban employees who had sympathy, or were they more likely, if they were working on the base, to have better feelings toward the Americans.
Especially considering that it's the 50th anniversary of the revolution. I mean, it's a very relevant question. And that I would say that it was mixed. You had 3,000 workers on the base. I was able to speak with workers who are very sympathetic with the revolution, and there's lots of stories, and much of this is oral, though there are written records as well, of Cubans who worked on the base and who raised money on the base, who were able to raise money from American sailors and Marines, who also there are stories of taking supplies off the base. Particularly, the story I heard the most often was of petrol. You could buy oil, gas cheaper on the base because it's not being taxed. And yet the workers did not see these revolutionary sentiments, this nationalism, as being at all contrary to the work on the base. They weren't trying to quit or to have the U.S. base leave. They just wanted the Cuban Revolution to be successful.
Because they didn't see a revolution as being something that would wind up in opposition with U.S. policies.
Exactly right. In 1958, the fact that the United States and Cuba wouldn't have relations within 2 years from then, I don't think was in people's imaginations.
I do get the impression from your book that both the Americans and the Cubans in many ways have benefited from their relationship. But didn't the Americans generally respect the Cubans as valued workers?
I would say that goes in several ways. I would say that many of the Cubans I spoke to valued their jobs on the base and that it was a moment where they could get some type of white-collar employment, which was really valuable. And some workers did feel respected by that. Others, I would say, did not and did resent the U.S. military's presence being there. And I would also say that when I spoke to women, that they had far less positive experiences as working as domestic servants than, say, the men I spoke to who would work in an office.
Was the message of the revolution that it was anti-imperialist a factor?
I would say that, in fact, the base workers in the 1959-61 period wanted to keep their jobs, and that even in 1959-1960, workers believed they could keep working on the base and be good revolutionary citizens. It's not until 1960 when the Cuban Revolution begins to have a stronger anti-imperialist, anti-American rhetoric. And for workers, as
declares itself communist.
Exactly.
This is the Cold War.
Exactly. And that for workers, it was about having to take their U.S. dollar paychecks and turn them into pesos. And so there becomes this whole black market in their dollars. And this is when their own work becomes suspect, when the Cuban government begins seeing these men and women as potential counter-revolutionaries.
So the suspicions were more on the Cuban side than the American side? Weren't there Americans who worried that some of these people might be there reporting to the new government?
Exactly. And so they're seen as suspicious suspects on both sides. The Cubans are having them go through strips searches on the Cuban side. They're having to change their money. They often are being watched. And on the U.S. side, there's also concern. These are communist spies. They're finding out about what's happening on the U.S. military, bringing it back to Cuba. And yet both sides allow these workers to continue commuting up until 1964.
And that ended when there was a confrontation between Fidel Castro and Lyndon Johnson.
That's exactly right. And when most of us think about conflicts between the United States and Cuba, we think about the Bay of Pigs or the Cuban Missile Crisis. This 1964 water crisis isn't what comes into our minds. But in 1964, there's this crisis between Johnson and Fidel Castro, this group of Miami fishermen or Cuban fishermen off the coast of Miami. And Johnson decides that the base needs to become independent. Fidel turns off the water supply to the base. So they say they're going to build a desalinization plant so the base can be self-sufficient with water. And secondly, we're going to fire the majority of Cuban workers. And for Cuban workers, this was really shocking. They'd been working, balancing this for the last 5 years. And in 1964, they're given a choice. Men and women were told, either you can stay on the base and you can have your U.S. pensions and keep your jobs, but you might never see your families again. Or you can go back to Cuba, be with your family, be part of the Cuban nation and government, but you'll lose your pensions, you'll lose your access to your economic security, and that's just gone.
So they either would live in exile in their own island,
right,
as permanent base residents, or give up everything.
Exactly.
And so is that what finally determined it? I'd imagine some people would, again, people who were under suspicion might have said, well, I'll live as a permanent base resident and then report back to the Cuban government.
Well, What happens is people do have to make a choice. Approximately 25% of the workers stay on the base and they do defect. And many of them do live on the base for some time and then most end up in the United States. The majority go to Cuba and they never see the base again and they're angry. And about 700 keep commuting.
I want to talk about them in a minute, but wasn't one of the incentives for defecting to the base the ability to send your family to live in the United States under the Varadero Family Claim Program?
That happens in 1964, 1965. And so for men and women who defected, they are able to get preferential treatment often through these programs to bring their families to the United States. Still about 20, 25% of the workers do that.
But you say some 750 workers, at least initially, continued
That's
to
right.
commute between the base and their homes in Cuba. These are people on the front lines of the Cold War,
yeah.
aren't they?
And these are men, and there were some women, although at this point it is mostly men, who exactly, they are allowed to continue commuting. And again, one imagines that they would continue to be under some suspicion by both the Cuban and the U.S. government. And both governments somehow make their peace with it. Either they want that information to continue being allowed to go through, and there also does seem to be some sort of neocolonial obligation on the part of the U.S. military for these final workers.
You spoke to a pair of brothers who mm-hmm. continued to work on the base. One was a defector and the other was a commuter.
That's actually information I got from a British documentary. So I did not personally interview those two men. But this documentary does an excellent job. It interviews these two men. And the one on the base in many ways says, yes, I wish I could see Guantanamo again. I wish I could see my family again. But he had family in Florida at that point and made peace with his decision. And his brother as well. His brother lived in Cuba. Rarely even spoke to his brother on the base, but he said that he was also satisfied with his decision to remain in Cuba. And so that this really, in some ways, magnified the division that many Cuban-American families have faced since the revolution. And here it's these divisions of families that are, in fact, only miles apart.
My guest is Janet K. Lipman, her book Guantanamo, A Working Class History Between Empire and Revolution. So we had thousands working on the base, and now we have hundreds. Who filled the vacuum?
In 1964, the United States began hiring Jamaican contract workers. And Jamaica had become independent in 1962. The United States, I found labor reports, had actually at one point considered hiring Americans, but Americans were seen as too expensive and potentially not particularly good employees. They're afraid about alcohol problems among the American population. And so they started...
Because they'd be so bored living in such a constrained space.
Exactly. And so for Jamaicans, this potentially could be seen as an economic opportunity. And so they begin hiring large numbers of Jamaicans. Although, again, this is not done in isolation. One of the first stories I found was a group of Jamaican men in 1964 who do not feel pleased with the way they are treated, who are angry at their employment conditions. And they actually have a meeting, which the U.S. reports on, saying that they are planning to march to Fidel and ask for help, and that they're having this organizing meeting where they want to essentially protest against the base and get help from the Cuban government. As you can imagine, they're quickly fired and sent back to Jamaica. And it seems as if most of this type of dissent is generally subdued. But the Jamaicans who come there are not without knowledge of the Cuban Revolution. You should also recognize the United States sees that it's critical to support Jamaican independence. So you begin having Jamaican Independence Day celebrations on the base. And this, to be honest, seems quite ironic, given that the United States is occupying land in many ways against the will of the Cuban government, but then celebrating the independence of Jamaica, which in some ways has less political power. They do this also with the Philippines. Many of the workers become Filipinos in the last few years. They have Philippine Independence Day on the base. And if you think that the War of 1898, the U.S. is going to the Philippines and Cuba, now the U.S. is celebrating Philippine Independence Day on the base, just the ironies of history sort of keep intertwining.
Considering the fact that the Philippines came to the United States as a result of the Spanish-American War, and Guantanamo came to us as a result of that as well. The Filipino workers were a little easier to handle than the Jamaicans. Is that why they were brought in?
I don't have evidence that would say that. I think that it's just that the Philippines right now, so much of their economy is based on remittances, that you have larger numbers of Filipino workers working abroad, and that it's part of a broader process of migration than anything else.
What kinds of contracts do these people get?
In the early part of the 1960s, they do still seem to be government-to-government contracts. Today, most of these employees are working for private companies, and most of this information I've gotten from the Guantanamo Gazette, which is online, and they seem to be private companies, cafeteria workers, groundskeepers, this type of employment.
So they do the same kinds of support work that the Cubans had done earlier, all jobs that have nothing to do with actual work at the prison?
Exactly. To my knowledge, and I should again say I've not been to the base, but these workers are not doing work with the detention camps. They're doing the maintenance work, the service work of the base. And if we think about the U.S. bases in places like Iraq or Afghanistan, again, the workers on those bases are not Iraqis for the most part or Afghanis. Most of the workers, especially in Iraq, are, again, third country nationals. These are people from Sri Lanka, from the Philippines. And if we think about your earlier questions about suspicion, the same reasons.
But you've also written that the Jamaican contract worker program was indicative of a new era of U.S. influence and power in the Caribbean.
I would say that that is true, and also that that specific moment is as the United States replaced the British imperial power in the early 60s. So if we think that the British in many ways has much greater influence in the early 60s, the U.S. really replaces that by the second half of the 20th century. But it also is indicative of patterns of outsourced labor, it's indicative of patterns of privatization, and it's indicative of patterns of third country nationals working for the U.S. military.
You've spoken with 13 elderly Cuban nationals who worked on the base. How did you get in contact with them?
I spent about 4 months in Guantanamo, Cuba, and it actually was very easy to meet people.
Could you meet any of them in Miami or other areas in the United States?
I most likely could have. I will admit that I did not go out of my way to find people in the United States, which actually would have been a great addition to the project. I did meet one person in Jamaica who was of Jamaican descent, and he had resettled in Jamaica. But the majority of the people I met, I would tell someone in Guantanamo, I'm doing work on the base. And I anticipated that people would say, you know, something political, or say, oh, whatever the U.S. is doing right now is, you know, reprehensible. But instead, what people said is, oh, my uncle used to work on the base. Would you like to come and speak with him? And in fact, the men and women I spoke to were very open about telling those stories.
One of them, Victor Davis, had commuted between Guantanamo and the base for more than 50 years. Mm-hmm. And two of the men you spoke with are still commuting 2 hours each way, mm-hmm. each day. Now, you talked earlier about the complications of being paid. How does that work today?
It's an excellent question. I should say that I use pseudonyms just to protect the privacy of some of the people I spoke to. But there, when my last visit, there were still 3 commuters today. And they wake up early every morning, they go to the base. And largely they do this because for workers who continued working after 1979, they started receiving U.S. government pensions in Cuba. And this was a large change. It said you no longer had to defect to get your Social Security check. You could stay in Cuba.
Just mailed to them?
No, not mailed to them. That's the point. These 3 men commuting bring that money across into the city of Guantanamo.
They bring them in as dollars or as pesos?
They bring it in dollars. They go to the Cuban bank, and at that point it is then exchanged to Cuban pesos. And this is a major source of the economy in Guantanamo, but it also demonstrates an ongoing relationship with the United States and a sense that these workers, in fact, are able to force concessions from the U.S. government.
Have you spoken to anybody since the U.S. election cycle started? Because President-elect Barack Obama has promised to close the detention facility at Guantanamo Base, and I wonder what that will mean for some of the people, the Cubans who remain there, or the other workers who remain there.
I would say a few things about that. For the workers, I think it actually, for the detention camps, would have very little resonance because their jobs simply aren't connected to the detention camps. The larger question is about the base more generally. And so you have many political figures saying we're going to close Guantanamo, but they're not talking about closing the base. And in fact, that's a place where I might actually differ from some of the workers who I interviewed, and that I think that the U.S. should close the entire base, that as far as symbolic gestures to the world that what has gone on in these camps is not permissible, that there no longer should be spaces outside of the law, that it would be in the United States' best interest and would not hurt it strategically at all to close the entire base.
Do you see this project, as you've written it, as being similar to the sort of thing that Howard Zinn has been doing in writing about American history?
I would say that's an interesting question. I'm familiar with Zinn's work, and it's a people's history. I would say that it's similar in that it tells the story of working people. I would also say that these working people had a lot of ambivalence and had a great deal of complexity in their relationship with the United States. One of the main points I hope people learn from this is that U.S. military power and influence does not end the day a war ends. That here we have 100 years, and that there's a great deal of complexity, of resentment, of personal ties, and that as the U.S. continues, in many ways, its expansionist policies, that we need to be conscious of that.
My guest, Janna K. Lipman, Assistant Professor of History at Tulane University, has written Guantanamo, A Working Class History Between Empire and Revolution. It's published by the University of California Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great. Thank you very much.